Kevin, I don't know where I am.
I'm recording this 2 weeks early. I think it'll be 3 weeks before any of the listeners hear this, because I am away this week, or I guess last week. I will have been away last week.
I don't know where I am. This is why I don't know where I am.
Oh, man. So, yes, we've just gotten wrapped up discussing the EM drive from a previous episode, which I gotta say is probably my favorite episode that we've done.
I agree. And maybe by this point, they'll have proven it.
Right. I mean, obviously, it was incredibly well-received. Everybody loved it. We're now at the top of all of the iTunes charts.
It was so well-received that the director of NASA heard it, and he increased funding for the EM drive, and they've proven it. So, welcome to the future, everybody.
I mean, we had plenty of other stuff to discuss in that episode, but we didn't because of the EM drive. One of which, and Alex, this is of interest to you because you'd like to work for NASA.
Yes.
So I have a question for you. Do you like Fortran?
I've never used Fortran.
See, I think that's the answer that you're going to get from most people, from most programmers.
I wouldn't mind learning it.
So the Voyager probe is very, very far away.
Mm-hmm.
It's been working on getting to very far away for a long time, and it is still going to be reporting back to NASA every so often for the next few years. I think till 2017, 18, something like that.
Right.
But the problem is that the last person who worked on the project is retiring.
Oh.
Which kind of makes sense. I mean, because the Voyager was sent out, I think, in the 80s?
Yeah.
70s, maybe? 80s?
I want to say 70s.
So, yeah, it's kind of done. And they've shut down a lot of the equipment on it because it's RTG. It's radiothermic generator. Is that the right?
We didn't look this up in between.
It will eventually decay to the point where it can't power the probe anymore, and so we'll be just kind of flinging a rock wherever it wants to go. But in the interim, they'd still like to be able to, you know, receive telemetry and stuff, and the problem is that this stuff is all written using very, very old hardware, and it's using Fortran. And so they've announced that they're looking for anybody, any cool up-and-coming computer science-y folks who've got their degree and are super skilled in Fortran now.
I mean, I could learn. I have a free weekend. I bet I can learn Fortran.
I guess the question that I ask: what are the languages that you have been? I mean, because you're still doing your education-y stuff.
Yes.
What are the languages that they're using in that environment?
So in school, they use three main languages: that's C/C++, Java, and Python. Most of the formerly taught classes there use one of those languages. There are some like edge cases, like specific classes will teach a specific language. Like there's a statistical analysis class which uses R, and then there's a web technologies class which, unfortunately, I think is really quite out of date at this point. Teaches like CSS and HTML and JavaScript, a little bit of JavaScript. But that's basically it formally.
And I mean, I think that kind of plays along with most of the stuff that that I experienced when I was taking my computer science courses. It was a lot of C, a lot of Java, a little bit of assembly for like the operating systems class,
Or
stuff on microcontrollers, that sort of thing, but very, very little of it. And I think it's interesting now because I made a video a while back where I talked about, you know, don't be afraid of picking up a particular language because most languages are all the same.
Right.
They have different words for things, but the method of constructing, I guess, sentences, for lack of a better term, the method of telling the computer what you want to do is largely the same between an awful lot of languages. That you don't suddenly go, oh, I need to completely rethink everything that I've ever thought about about programming just because I'm switching from Python to Ruby to Java to whatever.
Right.
I'm not sure that I could say the same thing about, like, Fortran.
I should have really learned Fortran before this podcast. that way I could have provided an in-depth... Maybe by the time you're listening to this podcast, I will have learned Fortran.
And it's interesting because Fortran was very popular back in kind of the 70s and 80s, and this was...
Yeah.
Right around the time where these higher level languages, kind of really starting with C++, started to come into their own. And now a lot of the education is taught using this object-oriented style approach. You know, there are different paradigms that you can take when you're looking at programming that you can kind of say line by line, you know, set this, you know, put 5 in this particular part of the computer, put 6 in this particular part of the computer, add these two parts of the computer and put it in this part of the computer, and you know, kind of step by step program that way. And that was kind of initially how computers ran in things like Pascal and Fortran and that sort of thing. We've kind of gotten away from that because it's very easy to mess things up.
Yeah.
And also we're just dealing with, there are a lot more spots in the computer where you can put things. And it's become just much more efficient to say, here, computer, I'm just going to say, give this thing a name and I don't care where you store it. Just know that when I want that name, give me back whatever it is.
Right.
And so it's interesting to me that I honestly wonder, like, what is going to be, what's going to happen with NASA now that they're in the position where they really have to support a lot of this technology. And there's certainly there are certainly companies that have kind of similar issues in that they have, you know, old legacy software that people are retiring and they didn't change the software and now it's hard to find people. But NASA is kind of in a unique position where it's not really like their fault. It's not like, well, you should have thought about this.
You should have seen the takeover of C and Java coming 40 years down the road. How could you, NASA?
Right. I mean, basically, it's kind of the equivalent of saying, you know, please program an entire space probe on, you know, an Atari 64.
An Atari 64?
No. Words. I'm sorry.
Did you combine the Atari 2600 and the Nintendo 64?
Yes.
That would be an awesome console. I want to play that now.
Oh, man. Can I edit that out? I can't edit that out.
No, because you could play Super ET 64. It would be just like Super Mario 64, except you'd be ET, and it would be worse.
Dang it, Alex. There goes all my credibility.
I'm sorry, Kevin.
Man.
You can earn it back.
That's embarrassing.
It's not embarrassing.
It's pretty bad.
Here, do you want me to say it, and then you can edit
it? No, we're okay. But no, I mean, it's interesting. And actually, the one thing that I am kind of excited about is this reminds me a little bit of KOS, the programming language for messing around in Kerbal Space Program. So I think I am incredibly qualified to take on NASA's Fortran position.
You should apply.
Having played a lot around with Kerbal Space Program.
We should both apply, and then see what happens.
There we go.
I mean, I'm looking for a job. That seems like a reasonable. I'd learn Fortran for NASA. Yeah. Be worth it.
I mean, every programmer, I think, probably has to deal with the question at some point of whether they want to be a specialist or a generalist. Whether they want to, you know, to what extent they want to stick themselves into a particular technology stack and really own various projects within that stack. And a lot of times there can be a lot of money in that sort of thing. I have to imagine that the number of Fortran programmers who feel like working for NASA is a very small number.
Yes, I'm almost certainly it is.
Not because people don't want to work for NASA, but because the people who know Fortran really well don't want to work.
Yeah.
They want to be done. And so there gets to be a point where if you are a specialist in these particular technologies, you can command a very high price point. But then what happens when, you know, because the Voyager program is going to be shut down within a few years. So we could become super awesome Fortran programmers for a few years. And we could perhaps command a very high price for our skills. Granted, it's NASA, so you don't know. But then where do we work after that?
So my question is, how much actually do they need to update and change?
I don't know. I have to imagine, though, that it might be pretty significant. I mean, if you're dealing with, because I think this isn't they're in extended missions now. This isn't,
right.
They didn't plan for Voyager to still be operable at this point.
Yes.
Right. So this isn't the, so I, and given that, I have to imagine that they haven't already programmed like this whole big shutdown efficiency routine. So if they planned for the thing to be dead 10 years ago, they probably said, well, it's just going to die. We won't worry about it. Now they're at this point of having to say, all right, let's selectively figure out how much power we've got. let's figure out how we can disable certain parts of the craft so that we can keep the rest of it alive a little bit longer. And then kind of continually doing that to eke out as much data as they possibly can get from it.
Okay, but I guess the question is, how hard is it going to be to write some code to turn something off?
I don't know. I haven't looked at the Voyager code. I mean, I don't know if it's... I mean, it's got to be public domain, doesn't it?
Maybe? I don't know. Did NASA fall under the purview of the Freedom of Information Act? Can you, like, ask NASA for their source code?
Well, I mean, because the thing is, their stuff isn't copyrightable.
No, it's not. So,
I mean, that's why, like, all of the NASA images and stuff, it's like, yeah, it's public domain. It's not even public domain because no one could ever own the copyright.
Right.
So it is public domain by default. So I have to imagine, maybe NASA has a GitHub account. We could just go, we'll submit a few patches.
I mean, that would actually be the way to do it, really.
Just
have Fortran. Does GitHub even support Fortran?
That's a good question. Now I want to look.
I mean, but like that poses some problems. Like you have these giant missiles, and like, oh, here's the source code.
So I searched for GitHub Fortran, and the top search result from Google was trending Fortran repositories on GitHub today.
What?
It just finds the most popular languages in a language, so it's like it's an automatic title, but like this is just as like an, like if you imagine that as being like a news story, that'd be hysterical. Yes, they do support Fortran. There is a hello world in Fortran.
Is that the trending for today?
it's one of them. I guess it's just, you know, whatever has been most committed to in the day, and they just do it by language, so you can look at.
I'm going to write everything from now on in Fortran so that my GitHub statistics for Fortran will be at the top.
There are a lot of oh my gosh. There is a JSON Fortran library. Oh man. I take it back. NASA probably is not going to have to pay much at all. Apparently they're a whole bunch of experts.
Just feed it some JSON.
JSON, by the way, is a format for structuring information so that you can pass it back and forth between various programs, and it's largely used on the web, but it is contemporary enough to really not deserve a Fortran library.
Yeah, I would agree, but you know, it was probably built for some legacy system and they wanted to feed new data into it. And
yeah, it was. I mean, you don't build it if you don't need it. Fortran, language of the future. I mean, it is interesting to some extent because there's a functional programming is really sort of having another swing at things.
Yeah.
And this is something that really kind of, to a large extent, died with Lisp and Scheme back in the 80s.
Mm-hmm.
Not that they weren't great languages, and not that people haven't continued to use them for some things and to teach those languages, but they just didn't have a lot of practical application because memory was very, very expensive, and these things required a lot of memory. Now memory is incredibly cheap, and all of a sudden everyone's going, oh my gosh, functional programming, that's the way to do things. So maybe Fortran is the next step. We'll start Fortraning all the things.
We're just going to keep going back and back. Like, and then eventually we'll have wire core. We'll just wrap around wire core because we'll realize that was more efficient in some way as well.
Right. Yep. With go-to statements.
Yeah. Like, it'll just be go-tos.
Yep.
That'll be the code of the future. Just go-tos everywhere.
Would there be some way to program something entirely using go-tos?
Well, what would it... It would just hop around.
Yeah.
If you could, like, go to...
You'd have to have three lines to make, like, a Turing machine.
Yeah.
You'd have to have a write and a read, and then as many go-tos as you want.
Yeah. I don't know, yeah.
A Turing machine, by the way, being a ridiculously stupid computer that can write and read and move. And that's all. But it's been proven that if you can do that, you could do anything given enough time.
Yes.
So it is a completely pointless and stupid machine, but it's important in that it's demonstrated that if you can do these very, very simple tasks, you could theoretically do anything as complicated as you might want.
Yeah, and if you're listening to this podcast right now, most likely you're listening to it on a Turing-complete computer.
That is true. Your computer can write things and read things, and it can move. It can move? Wow.
Well, I don't know. Maybe you're on a solid state drive, Alex. I don't know.
I mean, yes.
Okay, so yeah, now we know what NASA is looking for. But speaking of old and dead things, math.
It's very dead.
Yep. Old and dead and useless. So there was a post on Medium that had a lot of people up in arms about a kid who got marked off on a math assignment that instructed him to solve a problem using an addition sequence of 3 times 5. Or, no, 5 times 3? Yes, 5 times 3.
Yes.
And he wrote 5 plus 5 plus 5 equals 15. Huzzah! And it was marked wrong. Alex, why was it marked wrong?
So, the explanation I saw for why this particular problem was marked wrong is because there is a formal definition for order in defining the multiplication, this addition, like achieving multiplication by adding the components together multiple times.
Right.
And the formal definition required that the item that was being added together a certain number of times was the second number in the sequence. So in 5 times 3, the correct answer would have been writing 3 plus 3 plus 3 plus 3 because it was the second number given. So it was the method signature, essentially. So,
right.
You take in your first integer is how many times do you want to add it together? And the second integer is how many or what item do you want to add that many times?
Right.
And he violated the signature.
So the answer is obviously wrong. It's not 15. It's 15.
Correct. 15.equals15 is false.
And the reason that I felt it was worth bringing up here is that one of the articles that tried to kind of defend this talked about this being a very important distinction in computer science of soft equality versus, I guess, hard equality.
Yes.
Deep equality.
Yeah.
That you might say that if I give you an apple and I have an apple and we compared mm-hmm. those apples, we might say that those are soft equal.
Yeah.
They're both apples. But we wouldn't say that they are deeply equal. We would not say that they are the exact same apple.
Right.
And that the distinction is very important. And this is used a lot in computer science. But I resent that computer science should have anything to do with this stupid teacher's decision. Because I think that this has nothing to do with what's going on here. I think this is a matter of a computer, a human being dumb and ignoring the communicative property of multiplication and being mean to students.
Right. My question would be, how was it described? When the methodology was taught to the student, how was it described? Was it described saying like, oh yeah, I mean, it doesn't really matter either way? Or was it given like, you have to have this part first and this part second?
Well, but even then, I mean, so if you go with that definition, then you say this is how you go through successive addition. This is the process of successive addition.
Mm-hmm.
If you say you take the second thing and add it to the first thing number of times, even if
right.
that is exactly how it's explained, and that's exactly how it's requested, the student knows A times B is equal to B times A.
Yes.
Deeply equal.
Yes.
Even if the teacher has not taught that.
Mm-hmm.
And so it is perfectly valid to swap out the problem before applying that strategy towards solving it.
Right.
Whether or not the teacher has taught it.
So, two things. The first thing is, in school math, unlike perhaps a lot of real world, what you show on your work is more important than the answer that you get. Like, I've had plenty of times where I've had the right answer on a piece of paper, but I like made two mistakes that canceled themselves out in the work and gotten no, if, or very little credit.
Mm.
I mean, your thought process is important. And I think, and which gives to the second thing that I was thinking, order of operations is very important. We have PEMDAS for a reason, right? We have to know what order we execute
operations in, because it sometimes, perhaps not in this case, but sometimes it can have an effect. So you're driving home the point that, yes, operations happening in order is important. And you, even though sometimes you can flip things around, if you don't say that you flip this around and that there is this, you know, a deep equality between A times B and B times A, if you don't put that on the paper and it's not a step, then you're doing things out of order, which can hurt later down the line.
Nope.
No.
Nope. There are certain... If the teacher had required a mathematical proof, then yes. But in these informal contexts, there are certain things that are banal to the point of not bearing writing out. So, like, you wouldn't also say, given that A is a given that A is a real number, and that B is a real number, they do not contain any imaginary components. We can apply this property. You can flip the things around. It's not fine.
Not if they're matrices. Matrix order is important. If you're multiplying matrices together,
right? Exactly. So, would you have marked the student off if they had not indicated that 5 and 3 were not matrices? That is my point. That it is so stupid to have to state something like this that it is not worth saying.
I mean, the only other thing that I can say is that the level at what this was probably taught, grades don't matter. Like, whether he got this problem right or wrong, he's going to get through whatever math class he's in, right? And so by indicating that, no, this isn't quite right, you should have done it in this order, because order might be important later, is fine, right? Like,
I don't necessarily agree with you. I think that is particularly because tests happen from elementary school up until your postdoctoral studies, right?
Yeah.
And they remain a constant. And if we establish, this is kind of a different argument, but if you want to operate under the assumption that test scores don't matter, then if we train people to go, oh, I got it marked wrong, but that's fine, that's just feedback, then they're less inclined to avoid getting things marked wrong when they do matter. That if this is going to be a constant throughout your educational experience, we should treat it one way or the other. Not marking it wrong and scrawling all over the page about how idiotic the kid is for knowing the commutative property of multiplication, fine. You're a jerk, but I'm fine. You know, but actually marking them off, I think, is a problem.
Yeah, I guess by the same token, like, if you do, like, how, knowing how I process feedback on tests, if it's not wrong, I don't pay as much attention to the feedback, right? So by the same token, that perhaps teaching them that, you know, oh, I don't care if it's marked wrong, if it's not marked wrong, you're not going to care about the feedback.
I'm so the opposite. I don't particularly care what the score is. I'm just like, where's the essay you wrote for me? Flipping through the pages. I like feedback. I like feedback a lot, especially critical feedback.
Yeah, I mean, feedback is useful, but I don't know. It bothers me a little bit. Like, it just tickles me the wrong way. Like, and I know it's super useful, and I know this is perfect, like, a component of my own me, basically. Mm-hmm. But reading feedback on things like, oh, you got this wrong. The last thing I wanted to, like, right at the moment where I learned that it's wrong, I'm like, darn it. I don't care why it's right. It's wrong. Like, let's move on to the next thing. What did I get right? Like,
we are very, very, very different people. I don't ever want anyone to point out things that I got right. That's the worst thing in the world, because then they're drawing my attention to things that I've gotten right. These are things that I got right. They're things that I already know how to do. They're things that I could put on the back burner and just do automatically. I want my brain to be focused on all of the things that I've done wrong.
Right.
So, like, you know, there's a thing in acting. You don't ever say to someone, I really like how you did. I mean,
people disagree about this, but you don't ever say, oh, that the way that you, the expression of sadness when you heard the news about your long dead grandfather was fantastic. Do that again, because then they're going to focus on that. That's the thing they're already doing. I don't ever want people to say, hey, that was really awesome. I want them to say, here is what you should pay attention to, because then I can focus my efforts on fixing it.
Okay. So this, I should note, is a thing that I have specifically with tests, not projects or anything else.
Mm-hmm.
Like, if I write code and a project and I, like, okay, turn it in, like, I'm super certain this works. I've done a lot of testing. I get that back and it's like, oh, you forgot to do this. I'm like, oh, okay. Like, but whereas, like, I'm sitting in this closed environment, it's partially just I hate tests. And I think it spills into that. So I've sat in this closed environment for like 45 to 50 minutes, like, or maybe up to 2 hours if it's a long exam. And I've been trying to work through and get as many points as I possibly can. And I walk out and I'm like, I have no idea how I did. Like, I have fairly bad, like, later tells of how I did in exams. Like, I just can't tell until I get it back. So it's just a different environment, I guess, when it comes to tests. For me, personally. Like, I totally agree with everything you're saying. It's just the mentality I have with testing isn't that.
Yeah, I mean, we just have different experiences, I think. I generally have a good sense of, like, if back when I was taking tests, I don't have to take tests anymore, I'm an adult! No, back when I was taking tests, it was generally the point where I would walk out and I would know and remember the questions that I was a little bit concerned on. And so I'd talk with other people who had finished the test and I'd say, hey, so with question number 13, with the this and that, and I'd describe like the whole question and I'd describe what I had gone through and the assumptions that I had made and the, you know, to say, oh yeah, I think that was correct. Or, you know, that explained that it was wrong, but I would very clearly imprint kind of everything that I was any bit insecure about. Of course, that doesn't mean I'd have any idea, like, okay, is this completely wrong, or is this going to be a partial credit wrong, or whatever. But I have a sense of, like, okay, 6 of the 10 questions, I got. Now it's, so 4 of the questions, I don't know. We'll have to see how that turns out. And, you know, so that's kind of just a little heuristic for, I go, okay, you know, the number that I was confident on versus the number that I wasn't was my guess as far as I was doing.
Yeah. I don't know. I notice mostly when I get out of an exam, I just try to get as far away from the exam as I can. I don't want to talk about it. I don't want to think about it. I just want to get away from it. I just don't like tests.
I don't know. Tests are fun for me. They're puzzles.
Puzzles are fine, but they're puzzles with 2 additional stress components. One, a time deadline is, you know, whatever. But, like, if I do really... If I do poorly on this particular puzzle, like, it could mean I have to spend like months and months and months redoing like huge swaths of work that are completely tangential to this particular puzzle, like don't have anything to do with it.
I discovered a while ago that generally, so I mean, in college, I think you get fewer of the multiple choice / fill in the blank type of tests. You got lots more of show your work and solve some complex thing.
Yep.
Or even just essay questions on a particular, you know, explain how a processor works or, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
What I would discover is that generally, if you're looking at something and you realize there's a part of something that you don't remember.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, what is the difference between breadth first and depth search algorithms? And if for whatever reason I didn't remember what breadth first and depth first meant, I knew there were 2 different ways for searching. I couldn't remember which word meant which or something like that. And I knew classmates for whom if they had forgotten that, the question would just have been left blank.
Oh, yeah, never
they
do
just,
that.
They, you know, couldn't remember, didn't leave the thing. I finally discovered, I'm just like, I just write at the top. I say, I honestly can't remember which is which. I'm, for the purpose of this question, I'm going to assume that this means this and this means that. And then I just explain all the stuff that I knew.
Yeah. Getting partial credit.
And then generally, I wouldn't even get partial credit. I'd generally get full credit. And having gotten them wrong. It doesn't matter if you get the words wrong sometimes. Like, it's like you brain freeze sometimes. It's fine. And these were not, like, super happy, fun, lenient professors. But just, like, I would literally, and I'd end up writing, like, twice as much for those as I would for the stuff that I did remember.
Yeah.
But it was just a matter of, you know, yeah, here's something that I can't remember right now. I'm going to make these following assumptions in my explanation so that you know, how this stuff is derived. But with the understanding that if something else is wrong, I could also reach the right conclusion if I have the right starting data.
Yeah.
Right? And generally, that's all the professors really want. And I think a lot of people don't ever sort of clue into that. They go, I forgot, I don't remember the first step, so this,
yeah.
I can't answer this one.
I mean, that was me for most of high school until, like, my senior year. And then I realized, like, why am I not getting anything on some of these questions? I should be getting credit for what I do know.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, that has stuck with me through college and has honestly been, like, what, like, a huge help. Is just write down what you know, get the credit that, and sometimes you're right, you get full credit for something that you thought you wouldn't.
I wish I had learned that earlier.
Yeah.
I feel like we should just go in and, like, just as a public service to all first graders, like, here's how things are. This is going to improve your performance for the rest of your career.
Yeah. Write down what you know.
Right. But not, I don't think it's just write down what you know. I think you also need to make it clear what your guess is for the stuff that you don't know.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that they understand, okay, well, if that were true, if the Earth was a pancake, then yes, gravity would behave differently. I guess that does make sense, right? I'm super good at examples.
Yeah, you're the best exampler I know.
So there was another article sort of related to this about Common Core and why people hate it. I think mostly directed toward parents. Did you do Common Core stuff? Was that after your time? I don't...
No.
Okay.
See, I wish I had looked this up. Because now what I'm thinking is, when did Common Core become a thing? Because, like, new math and, like, different ways of thinking about math have been around for forever.
Right.
But I don't...
Can't take 4 from 3. 3 is less than...
Yeah. But they've been all around for forever. So what are people talking about when they talk about new math? And what is Common Core math? I don't know.
I thought that was part of the... I thought that was kind of an outflow of the No Child Left Behind thing. See, part of the thing is, for me, in learning kind of basic math, I was homeschooled when I was young. Mm-hmm. So my whole... a math experience was, you know, taught at home. So if math education had drastically changed, I wouldn't necessarily know of it.
Yeah.
I did memorize my multiplication tables. You know, that's apparently not a thing anymore.
Yeah. I went to a private elementary school and memorized multiplication tables. My sister went to the same one. What I should have done is asked my sister, who went to an actual, like, public high school, if she was exposed to new math or Common Core math and how that was different. I don't think it could have been terribly different for her because she didn't, like, she fail and she breezed through it from what I remember.
Well, I mean, I don't think it's necessarily supposed to be any harder. I think So from what I was able to gather is that the idea is, and the article that we're discussing starts off by saying that people are not computers. We don't just apply things. We need to understand why. Which I have thoughts.
Yeah.
Like to say, you can't just say 2 + 3 is 2 more than 3. You need to know why. Those numbers are too right. Yeah. There are some things where, yes, it's an algorithm, and you're just going to have to know that. But from what I understand, the focus of a lot of Common Core, at least what people are objecting to with Common Core, is that it is a lot more about figuring out clever ways to reduce the cognitive strain of solving a problem.
Right.
So if you're looking at adding 93 and 12, then rather than, you know, drawing them out and carrying stuff, or, well, 99 and 12. There you go. Then rather than saying, okay, 2 plus 9, carry the 1, blah, 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 you say, let's just make the 99 100, and let's make the 12 11, and then add those, because I can do that easy.
Yeah.
And the thing that just kind of struck me is that I was never, ever taught those sorts of things. The whole idea of, you know, let's just, you know, manipulate this one number and just hold that, you know, we'll take 7 away from here and then just keep 7 in a little bucket and then do the math and then put 7 back in, or, you know, whatever it is. Right. But I do that all the time.
Yeah.
To me, the usefulness of these heuristics, heuristics being shortcuts for solving problems, is I feel like they wouldn't have been useful to me if it was a, you're going to learn how to apply this strategy to solving problems. Like, the reason that they're useful is that I was stuck there trying to solve 99 plus 12 and then couldn't remember, okay, so wait, did I carry the one already? No, it's in that. And you know, realized, oh, good, there's a legitimate way to make this easier.
Right.
And then if it's a matter of learned this cool, like, it's because it was this cool secret trick, right? You didn't, like, your teachers didn't know you weren't actually adding 99 and 12, you're adding 111. It was like they didn't know you were getting away with stuff. You didn't have to add it the way that everyone thought you were supposed to. And you're all, like, clever and proud of it. I feel like if that's taught as a strategy, it just becomes another obnoxious algorithm put in your head, and you don't get the fun of doing that.
I mean, I not having taken Common Core math, I don't, like, I've seen some examples of it, but I don't know entirely how it's taught, and if perhaps how that fits together, if it's just weird, like, couple of weird tricks that they put together, like the weird tricks their teachers don't want you to know are now what's being taught. But I mean I have to imagine it's more formal than that, like, oh, just consider this number, you know, forget about the 112 and make it, you know, or your 12 and make it an 11 because you can shift it over to here. Like, it must be more formal than that,
right? I mean, and even in that example that we were discussing, there were a couple of other questions on there which said, you know, for multiplication, use this by drawing a matrix, drawing boxes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, basically they have to at some point be teaching a list of heuristics for solving multiplication and then ensuring that the student knows how to apply all of those.
Yeah.
So if you have, you know, instead of that your work couldn't just be 5 times 4 is 20 because duh, your work had to be 5 times 4, okay, here's a box that's 5 wide and 4 tall, and I'm just going to count all of the squigglies in them and go, oh, look, there's 20 of them.
Right.
So they had to kind of go through and teach these various steps and then I have to imagine that some of these heuristics aren't useful to people, to certain people. I don't have a very good visual memory.
Mm-hmm.
Visualizing multiplication by a matrix would not help me at all.
Yeah.
If I looked at a set of squigglies that were 5 wide and 4 tall, I wouldn't go, oh, let me just count those. I'd go, how wide is it? How tall is it? Okay, good, there are the numbers. Let me then do multiplication instead. Like, yeah. I would do the exact reverse
opposite
of that heuristic.
And maybe that's how they came up with that heuristic. Maybe like, oh, wait, everyone does that. We'll just do it in reverse.
Well, no, I mean, I'm sure that there have to be people. I mean, because I, granted, do not have a very good visual memory. I'm sure that there are people for whom actually visualizing that would be helpful.
Yeah.
And that problem becomes more solvable than 5 times 4.
I wonder if they did any, like, studies to see, you know, what type of, how people think. Like, how do the majority of people think?
Mm-hmm.
And then use that to build. Because if a majority of people think, you know, visually, then teaching things in a visual way is going to help the most number of students, right?
No. Do not teach the majority. No. You teach them, teaching the majority. Gross.
I mean, what do you teach to?
No, I mean, I think that ultimately the stuff needs to be tailored. To what the people do. I mean, the idea of foresight, you know, if you teach to the majority, then you're teaching blind people how to multiply by visualization.
Yes.
Then that's just dumb. And, I mean, obviously I'm taking that to a logical extreme. But my working memory is largely auditory.
Hmm.
And so listening and speaking things aloud and just like if I'm doing something like, yeah, pulling a 7 out of a math problem and then holding it, I'll speak it aloud and keep it in auditory memory and let it spin there for 20 seconds and refresh it if I have to and do my stuff and then pull it back from my memory of having said it. And like everyone, I think, has their own tricks for when they're solving cognitive problems.
Right.
But I think that they are very much customized to the individual. And the idea of we have to learn every trick that works for every person is perhaps not the best idea. And certainly robs us of the thrill that we get of like, yeah, I'm getting away with stuff because I figured out. I mean, it feels like it's a life hack. It's a brain hack. It's oh my gosh, I just figured out this really cool thing that works for me. Now, it's not a really cool thing that works for you. This is yet another strategy that you have to learn. Now, you don't just have to know how to multiply numbers. You have to know 7 ways to multiply numbers, 6 of which may be completely useless to your particular brain structure.
Yeah, no, I agree. I don't think, like, teaching the majority is not an optimal way. I'm just curious if that's what they did, right?
I mean, I imagine that they must have. From my understanding, most people are primarily visual.
Yeah, a lot of people are. It gets talked about a lot.
I don't understand these people, but but that is the majority of people from what I understand.
I don't know if I'm visual or not. Like, I don't know. It's hard for me to, like, I certainly think about things. Like, if you say a 4x5 box, I can think of, like, oh, I know exactly what that's going to look like, right?
Mm.
But I don't find myself using that type of visualization that often in, like, getting things accomplished.
Do you doodle?
I used to, but not anymore now.
I don't think I have ever doodled.
Okay, so...
So I think almost a lot of people doodle.
Yeah.
Like, certainly in school, because they're bored as heck, because school is terrible. But... But I think that's the thing, is that I think a lot of people do at least have some sort of visual instinct or some way of visualizing things that makes sense to them. It's not my thing.
Yeah.
And that's fine. And I think that means that, sure, for all of the visual learners, figure out the ways. I mean, I think there's every so often those competitions for memorizing digits of pi.
Right, yeah.
And the competitors will talk about how they don't actually memorize the numbers. They visualize these, like, landscapes.
Yeah, the Mind Palace.
Yeah, the Mind Palace. And they're reading out these various numbers and stuff. To me, this is the stupidest possible thing you could ever do. Like, how do you keep a landscape in your head? A number is a fixed thing. A landscape, that's and it's not just one landscape, it's a whole set of landscapes. It's all these different, like, megapixels upon megapixels of it. I can't. Nope.
I mean, I guess, actually, here's a question. Do you find whiteboards helpful? Like,
yes. With some constraints. Okay. Usually, I mean, I find whiteboards helpful, but I'm never really drawing on them. I'm writing words on them. And I'll occasionally have arrows between them that show the connections.
Uh-huh.
But I'm never like, drawing much in the way of representation.
Okay.
Even then, I find that different from actually visual. All that I'm trying to represent is the associations between symbols.
Yeah. No, I get what you're saying. I absolutely draw out, like, diagrams of how things are going to work and such. So I guess I am a visual learner.
Who knew? There you go. So yeah, we are different.
Yeah, I hadn't noticed.
By contrast, I can play songs in my head with, like, perfect fidelity.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that's just easy for me. Like, a song that I've barely heard, I can easily hear in my head. And given enough time in front of a piano, I could eventually, you know, make an arrangement of it and, you know, do whatever. Which
I
is not...
I could with practice.
Hmm.
I get songs stuck in my head pretty clearly.
Mm-hmm.
And I have worked out bits of songs on the piano.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I don't know. I'm not, that must be independent from visual, which is weird.
I do have, it's not a visual thing, but it's like a mind's eye sort of thing. I do have some of that with numbers, like sort of a synesthesia thing.
Oh, I'm jealous.
Like there is an actual physical placement to the numbers. It's not as cool as like, oh yeah, 13 is yellow, obviously. But I do have, and it's very much like a whiteboard, is that I have all these numbers, and it starts off as sort of a number line, but things are clustered, and there are lines like between 16 and 32, because duh.
Yeah. Powers of two, man.
That's not something I had to consciously think about. It's there as like a very strong line. Mm-hmm. And yeah, so I mean, there's a little bit of that, and it goes up to like 100, and then yeah, 1,000 is just put a 1 over here and then deal with this 100 space. But I think maybe that's what's gone wrong, is that the place where I should be like visualizing trees and fields and landscapes and all this mental palace junk, instead there's just this big number thing.
Number mess.
This number mess. I mean, it's cool. It's like this little web of stuff with all these associations just sort of there. But
yeah, I don't have like a permanent like mind space like that. It's just whatever it happens to be in my head, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
Just there, the thing of the day.
Yeah. But I don't know, I'm nervous. I don't care. Common Core, do your Common Core stuff, but I don't like the idea of saying that because you didn't apply this particular heuristic to solving the problem. I can understand that if you've already determined that that's what you're going to do, then yeah, you can mark them down. I still think that them not having said, I'm using the commutative property because duh.
Yeah.
I don't think that should count. But I think that don't force people to use a particular strategy to solve a problem. You can introduce them and you can let people hold on to them if they think that they're useful. But forcing people to have to memorize and then regurgitate all these strategies that are really designed to make life easier, and now becomes this chore that kind of undermines the whole point, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, it does. I agree with you. I can envision scenarios where, you know, it might have made sense in context, but on the whole, like, yeah, I don't think he should have been marked wrong, and I agree with you that problem solving is a hard thing to teach.
Should we move on to Star Trek?
I like Star Trek.
I like Star Trek. We should be friends.
Okay. I'll travel back in time and can arrange it so that we will already be friends now.
Oh, perfect.
Excellent. It worked.
Well done.
That sounds like a Star Trek plot, actually.
Oh, man. So, yes, there's a new Star Trek coming.
And that's all we know.
Yeah.
Like YouTube Red.
I'm of kind of two minds about this.
Yeah.
One is that we've kind of had a whole decade of let's just continue milking things for all they're worth thing.
Yeah. There have been plenty of sequels this past decade.
And two, I love Star Trek. I want Star Trek to come back. Yay.
I want good Star Trek.
Yes.
That's what I want.
Yes. So the one other thing is that it is going to be on CBS All Access or whatever their thing is.
Yeah, I saw that. Is that like it won't air on television like after the first episode?
I think they're airing the pilot on television, and then it's a note you can pay CBS $10 to watch it. Yay! So you know how Star Trek kind of struggles when they're coming back from a hiatus and trying to make a new series do well, and they need numbers?
No.
You know what the best way is to help out with that? Put it behind a paywall that no one other already is using.
I mean, yes, it will. I can see it not lasting more than a season or two.
That's my fear.
Optimistically, like I'm terrified that it'll be really amazing and then just won't last.
Yep.
Like that's like less preferable than if it's just bad,
right? It's like the Firefly thing. If Firefly was bad, we wouldn't be sad. We'd be like, all right, it was a good shot. Good effort. Now it's done. But it was amazing.
Yes, it was. And then it went away for no good reason.
Exactly.
Which is what I, like, this. I could see this new Star Trek becoming the new Firefly. Like, that is within the realm of conceivable possibility.
Right.
However, that being said, I would rather have one good season of new Star Trek than one bad season of new Star Trek. So I'd still rather it be good. But I want it. It disappoints me. I hadn't looked into it because it was too far away. But I heard rumors that it was only going to be on this paywall service. And so it disappoints me to learn that, yeah, that's not a rumor. That's, in fact, been confirmed.
And even then, not until 2017.
I mean, I don't mind waiting. Yes.
Well, no, but by that point, we'll already be paying $10 for some other shows. And
well, I mean, they're all access paywall, so you get access to all the CBS shows.
Right, like...
Elementary.
Like, what?
Elementary. Don't, it's like Sherlock, but not as good.
Oh,
although some people
perfect.
Like it. Some people like it.
So it'll be $10 well spent. I mean, we are getting to this point of just death by $10. There's been, I mean, I've watched, there's a little bit of the sentiment about how people are now kind of turning this into a, hey, see, you guys were all asking for a la carte options. Now you're not so happy, are you? They go, well, no, because this isn't a la carte. This is bundling. With more bundles.
Yeah, more smaller bundles.
Because there was the big, I mean, well, no, because there was the whole thing about cable, and people were being mad that they had to pay for all of these channels and they'd watch two of them. They wanted a la carte.
Right.
The idea now is that you're paying $10 per bundle and you're ending up buying, like, you know, if I want to watch one show on Hulu, I'd like to watch QI on Hulu. I think it's still on Hulu.
I don't know.
I'm not going to pay $10, but I'm not watching a billion shows on there. There's like, one or two good shows on Amazon Prime. There are one or two wonderful shows on Netflix. Netflix, I think, has a big value because of their back catalog.
Yeah.
But all of these services, I mean, it's just, it's $10 and $10 and $10 and $10. And you're not watching. I think it's, I've not encountered someone who just so happens to love everything on one of these things. And doesn't mind and like wouldn't watch stuff on the other ones.
Yeah, no, I'm sure there's very few people like that exist. Yeah, something's gonna give at some point. I don't know. People aren't gonna keep paying $10 for $10 here, $10 here, $10 here. At the end of the month, it really adds up, and people are gonna realize that.
Right. Well, plus there's Doctor Who, which is a whole other thing, because that you've got to pay the $30. You're not in the U.S. or you're not in the U.K.
Yeah,
And then you don't even get it on the day.
Yeah, that's the worst bit of it, actually.
Yeah, I do. There are two shows that I've just bought season download passes for, and that's $30. But I feel less bad about it because at least I'm just paying for that one show.
Right.
Like,
and then you get to keep it and watch it whenever you want and like offline and all that fun stuff.
Right. So it's Doctor Who and then it's Better Call Saul. Like into the two shows and I'm like, yep, I will pay money for those.
When does Better Call Saul come back?
About that. February. It's
totally
March.
Tangent.
I don't know. That is a good show though.
Oh,
they did apparently wrap shooting very recently for the season. So yeah, I love that show. it is stupid though because I'm paying $30 for that show when I could. I'm mad about $10 bundles, and I'll pay $30 for one show. It's more of just on principle. I really don't want to be stuck with this whole having to manage subscriptions. Okay, now the show's done, so let me cancel this subscription, spin up a different one. Like no one's going to do that.
No. Now, people forget they'll pay for the whole year for the show they watch for 6 months out of the year.
Right. I think that is why HBO is still around.
I mean, HBO is still around because people are willing to pay ridiculous prices for Game of Thrones.
Yep.
Like, people will pay their $100 a month, like, cable bill, $100 a month plus cable bill, specifically because of Game of Thrones.
Yep.
And that's just ridiculous to me.
I mean, obviously, we've seen this stuff with the YouTube Red stuff and the advertising and Hulu getting rid of advertising for paid folks.
Yeah, that was a big deal.
And it's funny because I was in a hotel recently and the internet connection was bad and I didn't have anything to do, so I turned on the TV. Like, Jeopardy was on or something. And I was like, oh, this will be fun. And, they read two questions and then go to commercial. I'm like, oh, man, I turned on right before a commercial. Fine. Come back, they read two questions and go to a commercial. They come back and read two questions and go to a commercial. And I go, oh my God, is this what life was like?
Yes. I know. I've watched a show recently with friends. We like got together and watched it live.
Mm-hmm.
And there were so many commercials.
It's just like, wow. And it feels so dumb because this is not something worth complaining about. I grew up with this. This is what life was, but oh my God. And this is cable that they're getting money for.
Well, Jeopardy wasn't cable, but...
Well, I know, but it was broadcast over cable. I don't know. I don't know how that goes with the... When the stuff gets rebroadcast, I wonder if the cable company does provide a kickback to the original broadcasters, or who knows?
I would imagine they must have.
But yeah, and I was looking through, I was like, maybe it's just this channel? Nope, it's all of the channels.
Oh, yeah.
but it is funny because, you know, I guess naively, you would think that Hulu doing a whole, pay us $10 a month, you get all of these shows, and you watch ads. And fewer ads than you would on TV.
Well,
Hulu, I just canceled because I'm like, this is too obnoxious. I can't handle all of the ads on here. And then I forgot what TV was.
Yeah.
We set the bar so far in one direction that I'm like, Hulu, no way, Hulu. I'm already paying you a whole $10. And you have the nerve to serve an ad in front of my 45-minute viewing experience?
So actually, here's a question. So Hulu doesn't... So there's two tiers of paid Hulu, right? There's Hulu Plus, which still has ads. And then there's like a Hulu ad removal tier. So it's Hulu Plus plus no ads.
You are right. There's a $7.99 plan and a no commercials plan for which they do not list a price.
Yeah. I think it's like somewhere like around $4 or $5 or something. I wish I knew how much it...
Oh, was. There we go. Okay, it's $12 a month for no commercials and $8 a month for limited
commercials. So it's $4. I thought it was $4. But So yeah, that should indicate how much they were getting from ad networks because presumably they were getting no more than $4 per subscriber for ad content. Like,
possibly. I mean, you never know. It could also just be that there's different brand deals in place or something.
I suppose.
I mean, you never know to what extent this stuff directly correlates. Everything's always weird.
Everything's always weird.
But yes, Star Trek...
Yeah, Star Trek. I like. What do you think they're gonna do? Where do you think they're gonna?
That's. I know. This is the part. This is the fun part. This is like. Let's. Okay. Economics and media and blah, blah. Star Trek. All right. So, first off, and I just want to mention this, be a little sad about it, and then move on. It's being written by the folks who did the reboot movies.
Okay, written. I heard they were still looking for a writer. It's being produced.
Oh, sorry, produced.
Yes.
Yeah, by the folks who did the movies. So I'm just going to be sad about that for a second, and then pretend I didn't hear it, and then be excited again.
So here's the thing. I heard the producer has like done TV shows before, that like Inhumans or something like that, or he Fringe. He was a producer on Fringe. If you've seen Fringe...
I have not, but I will put it on my list.
You need to watch Fringe. Fringe is one of my, like... If it was still on the air, it's ended, it would, like, be the only contender for, like, Doctor Who. Like, it was for my favorite show. Like,
okay,
I really like Fringe. And he was a producer on Fringe, Which, when I saw that, I was like, okay, it'll be fine. It'll be good.
I think the instant that they drew any connection with the new movies, I was like, oh, I don't know. Come on.
Yeah.
I should admit, I have not seen past the first reboot movie.
Well, there's only been one more past it. There's been...
Okay. Yeah, I just... No, don't care to. I mean, don't take all the things... It's like when they made the different Willy Wonka.
Yeah, no, that
Gene
was
Wilder
awful.
Isn't even dead.
Television credit. I'm just curious if you've seen... He was co-creator, executive producer, consulting producer, and writer on Fringe for its entire run.
Okay.
Alex Kurtzman, who is in charge of this new Star Trek, or is the executive producer. He done Xena Warrior Princess.
Okay.
Sleepy Hollow, which is, I've heard is actually a pretty good show. Those are the big ones.
But okay, so concern / excitement about the people involved. Let's go to just wild speculation.
Okay.
And be all nerdy and excited.
Okay.
What's going to happen? Opening scene, Alex.
I really want Picard. I want Picard to be in the opening scene. Like, I know he won't be in the whole show. That's fine. But, like, Picard was in the opening scene of Deep Space Nine, or the opening episode, and Quark was in the opening scene of Voyager. So we have to have, like, either Janeway or Picard in the opening scene, and I'd be happy.
You're forgetting Enterprise.
Yeah, but when they did the thing, they wound up with Fat Riker.
Actually, no, here's an idea. Let's just have a series that's just Picard 20 years before the Enterprise. Because Patrick Stewart could totally do that.
He doesn't age. He's Benjamin Button, really.
Exactly. Totally doesn't age. Just like a 20-year-old Captain Picard doing all sorts of Picard-y things.
Yeah. He could be on the Stargazer. Be great.
Yeah. Ooh.
Be great.
Ooh.
I don't know.
Well, actually, so here's the thing. Do you know Kelsey Grammer was originally going to be the lead on Voyager?
I don't know who Kelsey Grammer is.
Frasier?
Never seen Frasier.
Oh, my God. Yes, you know who Kelsey Grammer is.
I might not, Kevin.
You know who Kelsey Grammer is.
Oh, he's a guy. There's nothing on the filmography I would recognize him from.
That is... Wow. Okay, but yes, he was originally going to be Captain Janeway, and then they made Janeway a woman. I think Kelsey Grammer ended up going into rehab right before they cast.
Really? So they were going to cast a guy, and then their choice... Really?
Well, Kelsey Grammer is really awesome.
I mean...
Like, would have been a great show as well. To be honest... I'm gonna irritate all the Star Trek fans. I enjoyed Voyager a lot.
Oh, so did I.
It is the Star Trek candy to me. It's like I could just like put it on and watch it and enjoy it and not think about it too much. Like, it doesn't bother me. I know it bothers a lot of people, and I'm just like, this is just fun. And yeah. I won't argue that it's anything close to the best. But I'm like, I enjoy watching Kate Mulgrew, I enjoy watching Robert Picardo. I enjoy, and I think the cast overall was much better balanced.
Yes.
Than most of the series. That the level of talent across the board was probably much better. I feel like Next Generation had a couple of really great actors that had a couple of mediums.
Yeah.
And yeah.
So my only criticism about Voyager is just its overarching plot. And again, what it has to do with the rest of the Star Trek universe. Like, it was the biggest annoyance was, like, they kept almost getting home and then something would go wrong at the last second. Like, that happened. It was like the monster of the week type thing. Like,
it's called a try-fail cycle, yes. Alex, and it's a basic building block to storytelling.
But it was like the whole plot of like the show.
I sort of agree. I wish that they hadn't had a lot of like close calls of almost
yes.
getting back. Like, I feel like that was overdone. I feel like
yes.
they could have done a lot more of just like exploring the evolution of the ship over time, sort of in a BSG sort of way, really.
Yeah.
And actually, BSG was largely staffed with frustrated Voyager writers.
Yeah, there was like a schism. They were like split. Didn't they? It was weird. No, but anyway, like, so Voyager could have done, like, just not have them go home, like, almost get home, like Gilligan's Island did every other week. Like, it felt like Gilligan's Island in space for a while. Like, I mean, it really did.
I would have loved to see them actually form a fleet, like a small fleet, but over time, like, form a fleet.
Yeah, that would have been cool.
Like, I would say still continue heading home.
Yeah.
But, no, don't try. That would have been, yeah.
And then at the end, when they, like, spoilers for a 2-decade-old show, at the end, they, like, destroy the whole Borg collective, and, like, I didn't like that.
Yeah, it was a little weird.
Yeah.
A little.
But I want to see what happens.
The problem is when you undermine a villain that's supposed to be mostly omnipotent, it kind of calls into question the villain to begin with, and it's the whole.
Yeah. Yeah, I didn't like that.
Like, Voyager's not, like, the ship that's going to take down that entire race. Well, like, if anybody in Star Trek's going to take that, it's not them.
Well, yeah,
like,
but remember, the reason they were able to take it down is because future Janeway contacted them and told them how they figured out how to destroy the Borg.
Ooh. The time
police.
Guardian.
Yes.
Things.
The time baby.
Could we have no? Just like the whole like the future Federation time guardians.
Yeah, I remember.
Could that be the series?
That would be pretty cool.
That'd be awesome, right?
Pretty
Let's do that.
Cool.
And then you could have cameos from anybody you wanted, anybody and everyone,
including
except for the new
Riker.
Star Trek movie jerks.
Yeah, no one wants that. Except I'm terrified that's going to be what it is, but, you know, no one wants that. I mean, they can't, right? Because Chris Pine and Zachary Quinto and all those people are, like, too high paid. They can't put them on a TV show.
I hope so, but I don't know. I mean, I guess I still don't entirely understand what the idea was behind the reboot.
What do you mean? The mechanics?
No, not the mechanics, but just the decision to do it. Was it a matter of just they had too much canon and they felt boxed in? Because if that's the case, then it points strong. Like, if really everybody who wanted to bring back Star Trek was trying to come up with ideas, and the only thing that they could do was, we got to blow up all the canon that we've created because we're in a straitjacket, that probably would hold true for a new TV show as well.
I don't know. I mean, I can only assume that at some point they were like, we're making Next Generation movies. We're making Next Generation movies. And then what changed after Nemesis? I mean, Nemesis didn't do very well in the box office.
Well, also, Brent Spiner's like, I'm too old to be playing an android that doesn't age.
Right, which is why they killed him. But why they killed them killing him makes me think that they were, like, thinking about doing another Next Generation movie, and so they wanted to get...
I don't know. Maybe, I don't think so. I think that's more of just, you gotta keep your options open. I don't think it was a, hey, so, if, you know, we've got something in the works, so don't kill them off, just in case.
Yeah. I mean, but they introduced B4, and canonically, like, in the canon, although I don't know how you want to define this canon, because running up to the reboot of the Star Trek movie, there was a series of novels, not novels, like graphic novels, I should say, that were released and are canon for at least the new movie and form the tie to the reboot. So what, basically, in that, like, so it sets up, like, Spock going back and, like, all of the things that lead up to the beginning of the movie, it sets them all up. But it stars the Next Generation crew. So, like, you have Picard and then Data living in B4. Like, his conscience, like, fully amalgamized and became Data again inside B4. And so it's, like, all those characters doing all the things they did with the Romulans and such that wound up sending Spock back in time and kicking off the whole reboot movie.
Okay. Well, okay, here's another question for you. Just speculation. Should we give Will Wheaton another chance?
Yes. I think he deserves another chance.
Should we just make that the series? He gets a vessel.
No. That's not the we can have him be, you know, still Ensign, you know, Crusher for Worf.